talking about oil. Black gold, as it's also known. So yeah, I lived in Houston, Texas prior to coming to PSU, and I worked in the energy industry, so have a bit of firsthand experience as an exploration geologist, and that role involves looking for oil, natural gas, etc. And so this is an area that I have experience in and have had a chance to think a lot about. So it's naturally interesting to me. We're going to be talking about oil, as is shown in this slide here. We also have natural gas and coal. We already talked about coal. We will talk about natural gas, but let's look at some of the countries that are producing the most oil. So we have Saudi Arabia, Russia, and the United States listed here. You can see up in this upper part. And then production is in billions of barrels per year. So oil is generally measured in barrels of oil, right? Saudi Arabia is the highest. Russia, not far behind. United States, not far behind. Reserves. So how much oil do these countries have that they could produce at some point in the future? Saudi Arabia tops that list handily. 266 billion barrels, basically, with Russia. Almost over doubling, actually, the United States. So we are producing quite a bit. We, at these rates, would run out prior to Russia and Saudi Arabia. Natural gas is interesting to look at. So the United States, you know, has billions of cubic meters. Now we're looking at volumes. Russia and Iran both have very large amounts of natural gas reserves. In terms of production, though, the United States is producing quite a bit. And then coal, we talked about coal already, but this is still kind of interesting to review here. Notice that the reserves of coal, the United States has the largest amount of the ones listed here, at least. That's China and India. Russia, also 173 billion tons, so sits somewhere between the United States and China. Okay, but yeah, the U.S. has a lot of coal. Hopefully we find cleaner sources of energy so we don't have to use it all. That'd be fantastic. Okay, so more on oil. Before we get into that, I want to think about sedimentary rocks a little bit. So, you know, I've mentioned this before, but sedimentary rocks are ultimately things like sandstone and mudstone. So grains of material that move down streams and are oftentimes deposited in a delta, so on the continental margin where the rivers come into the ocean, like we have in the Columbia River Delta. You get these layers of sand and mud that when that stuff is buried, it becomes rock, so sandstone, mudstone. And it's generally laid down flat, and so that you have these layers, right, where the oldest strata at the bottom, and then a subsequent layer comes in and gets deposited on top, and then another one on top of that, on top of that, on top of that, etc. So that these layers of sediments, which have become rock, are getting younger as you move what we call up section, right? Each of these layers. So they're laid down flat, and then they get younger up section. Some of these rocks, why am I talking about this? We're talking about oil. Some of these rocks happen to be good reservoir rocks for oil. So in other words, they can hold oil in their pore spaces. Well, what am I talking about? We looked at this when we thought about groundwater. Pore space is the area between different grains. So we have maybe sandstone grains, sand grains. And between those grains, you have open space, and you can fill that space with fluids. In this case, we're talking about oil, right? So you have some porosity in the pore space. You also potentially have permeability, which means those pore spaces are interconnected, which allows that fluid to move in and out of the rock. You can imagine that's also very important if you're talking about oil exploration. And this image here just gives kind of a nice real-world example of a photomicrograph, so a magnified image, ultimately, of a sandstone. And the pore space, the fluid in the pore space is colored as blue, okay? So you can see pore space exists in here. There's some amount of fluid in the areas between grains in that rock, right? So if we take those layers that we were just looking at, okay, in reality, even though these sediments are laid down flat, oftentimes they end up being folded or deformed over time, okay? So you end up with interesting geometries like we see in here where you have layers of rock, right, that then may maybe dip upward, and then you even have a fold here, which, you know, this would be an anticline, so it's something that looks like an upside down bowl. And then it continues up to the surface. And what'll happen is that you have, let's say, your reservoir rock, like a sandstone, and you can see that's labeled here reservoir. Some of these rocks are going to have pore space, other ones won't. Or maybe other ones won't be permeable. So maybe they have pore space, but they're impermeable, so you can't move the fluid through. So that would be a non-reservoir. But in this case, this diagram is showing you have a reservoir rock like a sandstone. Limestone is also listed here. Limestone is a very common reservoir rock for oil. But you have a reservoir rock that comes through here that can hold fluid, and then between, which are these gray layers, these are rocks that either don't transmit fluid, so fluid, they are non-permeable, or they just have no porosity either, right? And in this case, you have on top of it this layer of relatively impermeable rock. It could be a mudstone, for example. It could be an evaporite, so something like salt. But ultimately, that layer is impermeable, so the fluid that collects in the reservoir below cannot continue through that layer above and escape ultimately to the surface. Okay, it makes it so that the reservoir rock holds on to that oil over a long period of time. You also need to have a source rock, which is shown down here. Okay, where is this oil or gas even coming from in the first place, right? It may exist in the pore space of a sandstone, but how did it get there? Where did it come from? Well, the where did it come from and the how did it get there would be source and migration. So source rock is, for oil, going to be marine organic material. So the source rock is going to be an organic rich, probably marine mudstone, likely, and it's just got a lot of organic content. So as it cooks in Earth's pressure cooker, eventually it starts to crack and it starts to form oil and gas, and that oil and gas slowly seeps out of the source rock. It has some buoyancy, so it's moving through the source rock, seeping out into overlying reservoir rock, into the pore space of maybe an overlying sandstone. Okay, how does it get there? Well, through migration. So you have to have some way, a pathway, to get from that source material to the reservoir, and that's what migration is referring to here. So there's all these different elements here: source, migration, reservoir, seal, trap. These are different play elements, is what the oil industry would call them. And they're generally recognized as features that are necessary in order to have a successful oil or gas well. Okay, you need all five of these to exist. You need a reservoir rock, a migration pathway to get from your source to your reservoir. You need a seal, so something that keeps the oil or gas in place as opposed to letting it escape. And then you need a trap, so some sort of a geometry, a structural trap like this sort of upside down bowl here, right, in order to cause it so that your oil and your gas accumulate, okay, like this, in your reservoir rock. So that's sort of a quick and dirty, petroleum geology in, what was that, 5 minutes or something. People teach entire classes on this subject. So this is how it exists in the subsurface. Okay, very interesting, very important. But as an exploration company, whether you're talking about the Exxons out there or the Chevrons out there or the BPs, whatever, as an exploration company, you're ultimately trying to figure out where you're going to drill your well. And so how do you know where that accumulation of oil and gas exists? Well, the way you do it, one of the ways you can do it, at least, there's a couple ways, but one of the ways is through collecting seismic data. Okay, and what is seismic data? Well, ultimately, you have a source. So in this case, we have an explosion, right? And that creates pressure waves that travel through the subsurface. And as they hit those layers of rock, right? Remember, you have sandstone, mudstone, etc. Some of the energy of that pressure wave dissipates and is reflected back to the surface, okay, along that boundary. And you have a listening device, as it says here at the surface, like what would be called a geophone, for example. And that's just listening at the surface to see, hey, is that wave, that source that just sent a pressure wave through the earth, is that wave returning back to the surface? And if so, how long did it take to get here from the time that the source went off? So you have 0.4 seconds, 0.8 seconds. And the longer the time, the deeper that interface. So you can see, through this data, ultimately you can create amazingly pictures of the subsurface. So let's see how that works a little bit more closely. So you have your source at the surface, right? This is an elastic wave, so it's a pressure wave, just like sound waves moving through the air. hitting my eardrums, giving me some information. These are pressure waves that move through the earth, okay? You also get these waves happening in earthquakes, by the way. But you can create the source through an explosion at the surface. And so that's what's happening here. You get your source, the wave starts to propagate into the subsurface. So this line right here represents the surface, okay? And it's propagating into the subsurface. You can see it's kind of a semicircle. Oh, and look, it hits an interface here. This line coming across here represents some sort of a boundary, maybe between, let's say, salt and sandstone, or sandstone and mudstone, or whatever. Two different rock types, okay? It hits that interface. Some of that energy is reflected, as is shown here. Some is transmitted right on through. Okay, that reflected energy, what's going to happen? Well, let's continue on. So time continues, some of that reflected energy, see how it's getting closer to the surface? And boom. Okay, it just hit the location of the source. And in this case, I have a receiver, so a listening device in the same location as my source. So the source goes off, sends the wave down, goes down, reflects off this interface, the wave comes back up, and my listening device hears it come back to the surface. It records how much time it takes for it to go down to that interface and come back up, okay? And it records that information on the y-axis here. So see, time is going down, okay? Time is like depth. It's not the exact same thing, but in seismic data, it ends up being pretty much depth, okay? So time is going down as is depth is going down into the subsurface, and then I had this waveform that came back and hit me. And I record that waveform at a certain time, okay, which again corresponds to a depth. If I keep doing this over and over again, source, listen, source, listen, source, listen, source, listen, I get a series of waves at a very specific time according to where that interface is in the subsurface. I can start collecting those, and I can start putting those together into an image, and look at what starts happening here. They start creating a pattern across space, right? All these waves coming back to the surface. And if I do it enough, I end up with an image like this. This is ultimately what we were just looking at, just a much more complicated version, right? You have grayscale, so it goes from white to black, and then there's a lot of gray in between. And ultimately, the white, in this case, well, I can tell you, in this case, the black is positive and the white is negative. Okay, I'm not going to explain how I know that right now because it would take too long. But ultimately, see the waveform down here. Let's go back one more. It goes positive, and then it goes over here into negative territory. So this side is positive, this side is negative. Right, so that wave represents some positive energy and some negative energy, and that comes out in black and white. So black is positive, white is negative. And so as that wave hits all these different interfaces, it comes back to the surface and it starts creating a series of what we call seismic events, and that's what all these are. Okay, and what that does, it tells us what's happening in the subsurface. It actually gives us an image, this is a seismic image, of layers of rock in the subsurface, which is pretty amazing. So you have like layers of sandstone or mudstone or something like that in here. This big blob that looks like kind of an amoeba or something, you know. This is very large scale, by the way. We're talking kilometers across the surface. But this is sort of a big blob. Anybody have a guess as to what this is? If you get this quickly, you would get extra credit in my book because I feel like this would be very difficult to guess. This is actually salt. This blob of material is salt. So salt kind of acts like ice does on long timescales. Okay, so ice is, many people know, if you accumulate a bunch of ice on a mountain, you can form a glacier, right? And glaciers are moving. That's solid material that's moving downhill, right? That solid material is kind of acting like a fluid on long timescales, right? Salt does the same thing incredibly. So on geologic timescales, we're talking long periods of time, millions of years, it actually acts like toothpaste or like a fluid in the subsurface. It moves around, it squirts around and such. And that's what we see here. This is like a blob of salt in the subsurface. So at some point you had a layer of salt that was deposited at some depth, And that salt existed because it's an evaporite, right? So you have all this water maybe in a lake, and the lake evaporates out and leaves behind some amount of salt in the subsurface. And eventually that salt mobilizes because it acts like a fluid on geologic timescales and creates really wild, insane blobs like this. We would call this a canopy, a salt canopy. Okay, but I don't know if you remember this, but in an earlier slide, I mentioned one of the really good sealing rocks out there. In other words, a rock that fluids cannot penetrate easily, right? That blocks fluids from moving through them, is salt evaporites. Evaporites are wonderful seals. So one of the things you could do is you could be like, oh, look, underneath the salt here, there's like a little bit of an anticline or a little bit of a fold here, a little bit of a high. Maybe I have some accumulation of oil or gas right here under the salt, because if it accumulated up into this little nook, it would not be able to continue up towards the surface because the salt is impenetrable, right? So that's what, at least part of what an exploration geologist does, is look at images like this, map it out, try to figure out what's going on, and then be like, oh, I think that I have some oil and gas in this little nook, for example. Let's drill a well, see what we see. Okay, so let's say we find a really interesting prospect, oil prospect, by looking at seismic data from the Gulf of Mexico. Okay, that's what we're looking at here. Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, etc. This is the Gulf of Mexico. And so offshore, that would be in the Gulf of Mexico itself, in the marine environment, you have a lot of leases, lease blocks that the U.S. government, the federal government, leases to oil companies for oil and gas drilling. And this is what's being shown here. All this green, all these little green things, these represent places where you have active leases. So oil and gas companies are actively exploring, or maybe they're producing already. Maybe they already have found oil and gas and they're just producing it. Maybe they're appraising a discovery. So in other words, you can have an exploration well where you're like, I don't know if we're going to find it. You drill a well. Oh, we found some. Fantastic. Everybody's all happy because they think they're going to get rich. Okay, but now we need to appraise it. We need to figure out, hey, we got some oil in that well, but how much is actually down there, right? And how big actually is this accumulation? That would be the appraisal stage where you go drill just a couple more wells around the edges and see if you can define the exact size of that accumulation. And then you might go on to production, which is where you're like, okay, now we know the size of it. We feel like we're pretty good about being able to produce this stuff. Let's drill wells in like in a strategic way. And that's when engineers are primarily working on it, not so many geologists anymore. But ultimately, let's produce this in a certain way to maximize, right, the amount that we can bring out of the ground. Okay, but let's back to the lease block stuff, which this is pretty interesting. We're going to spend a minute on this. You have different areas, the western, central, and eastern. Notice eastern against Florida, very little. This is pretty much a carbonate platform out here. It's a little bit different. And then the Mississippi River comes in here, and you get quite a bit of exploration and production outside of Louisiana and then also Texas. You can see the acreage here, number of leases, acres that are leased, etc. Okay, 23 million, almost 24 million acres are being leased in the Gulf of Mexico offshore. So in the marine environment, it's amazing. It's a lot. Okay, so just as an example, I want to sort of walk you through a lease sale because, like I said, it's kind of interesting. So this is from 2020, so it's a little while ago, but it'll give you a sense. So we have two different columns here, 12 and a half total, 18 and three quarters total. These are the royalties ultimately that are paid to the government. So let's say that you go out and you find some oil, you're a company like Chevron or Exxon or whatever. You go out, you find some oil, you explore, and then you start producing that oil. You're going to sell it. You're going to make a bunch of money. The government's going to take 12.5% in this column, 12.5% of everything that you sell is taxes, basically. They're going to say, okay, we're going to take 12.5%. In this case, 18 and three quarters. That's kind of where we're at today for the most part. You can see the vast majority of tracts are at an 18 and three quarters percent royalty rate. Okay. So in this 2020 lease sale, which these lease sales are really wild, I had a chance to at least watch them as they were happening and kind of be involved in them to some degree when I was in Houston. But these lease sales are pretty fascinating. They happen oftentimes in the Superdome in New Orleans. And I mean, not out on the field or anything, but there's like convention centers and things. And ultimately, you know, people will do silent bidding. So different companies will make a bid on lease blocks. and then they'll read live the results of those bids. So who gets the highest bid, et cetera. And it's kind of exciting. It's like, oh, did you win or not? But anyway, so, you know, for example, in 2020, when they did this, in these 18.75% royalty blocks, of which 65 received bids, we had a sum of all bids. Let's go to the high bid. So the high bid is going to be the one that wins it, right? So if you just add up all the high bids, well, how much does that amount to? In this case, we're talking $92 million. Okay, $92 million in this 2020 lease sale. And again, and also I haven't mentioned this, normally, under normal pandemic, it was a little different, but normally there's two lease sales a year. Okay. So, you know, this is what, you know, the government is ultimately getting. It's known as a bonus, you know, in order to secure the lease for the block, right, is what you're getting. So let's just take a look at this. It's kind of interesting. We'll watch a video. This is super boring maybe to people, but I just want you to see. This is for that lease block we were just looking at. So the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, this is from 2020, Gulf of Mexico Regional Office, sale 256. It's a federal agency.
Welcome to BOEM's live stream broadcast of Gulf of Mexico lease sale 256.
There you go.
This is the 131st federal offshore oil and gas lease sale to be held for the Gulf of Mexico. These Gulf of Mexico lease...
Okay, real quick. I mean, this is 45 minutes long. We are not watching the whole thing. I'm going to just jump in a little bit.
$600,311.
Okay, so they're actually reading the bids and the results of the bidding right now.
We're at 50% of our bids received today. Okay, Mississippi Canyon Block 757, one bid. BP Exploration and Production, Inc., $600,311.
Okay, so there was one block that just went up for sale, right? And there was only one bid, so they're going to get it. It was BP, $600,000 and change. I mean, that's a pretty low bid, actually, but, you know, apparently it's not very competitive. So, you know, the company, in other words, is like, yeah, we don't really think there's likely to be oil there, but let's go ahead and just do a low bid and in hopes that maybe we get some more data at some point that suggests that maybe there is. If you look here, highest bid per track, I mean, there was a bid in this 18.75% royalty column of, what is that, $11.1 million, right? And that's just a bonus. So that's a really high bid, over $11 million for one lease block. And these are, if I remember correctly, these are 3 miles by 3 miles, so 9 square miles in area. That's the size of these things. For this one, it was competitive. There were two bids. So that's kind of interesting. And yeah, so it can get pretty high. I mean, it can go northwards of $20 million in some cases for blocks where there's a lot of certainty or relative certainty that there's going to be an accumulation. Okay, so that's kind of what's happening there. Oh, I had one other one, company's bid summary. So this is also just another kind of interesting thing to look at. This is for the same lease sale and just gives a breakdown. I mean, this is stuff you can find on the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management's website. And you know, it breaks it down by company. So this is Hess Corporation. That's an oil and gas company. And you can see that they did a couple different bids here, about 5 million in bids. And it sort of tells you the outcomes of those, right? Upper half, lower half, the high bids. They had two of their bids were high bids. One was not. And then, you know, Chevron did a whole bunch of bidding. You know, the highest bid they did was about $4 million. Most of those were against themselves, you know, but the companies don't know, right? I mean, you're making a guess as to what other companies are going to think is valuable. I mean, it's like eBay for, well, sort of, yeah, it's kind of like that, right? It's an auction. So you don't really know what you're going to get. And there's a lot of sort of financial calculations that go into this stuff. But yeah, I kind of want to find the one that was really, really high. It was $11 million. It should be in here somewhere. Oh, that was 1.5. There it is. Look at that. And who is this? Oh, didn't really come out that well. This is 11, or it's almost $12 million. This is Equinor, Gulf of Mexico LLC. Oh, and funny, look, Repsol Exploration and Production USA. Repsol is actually a company from Spain. But that's $12 million. So it looks like they and Equinor both, so they were probably partners on that. Probably maybe 50-50 on it or something like that. So yeah, a lot of times companies will go in with other companies to split the risk, you know, so that they're 50% in on a lease block, for example. Okay, well, let's continue on here. Okay, I might need to actually take my picture off the screen here so you can see what's going on in the corner. There we go. So just a summary of kind of some of the money that's involved in these lease sales. So onshore, that would be on land. Offshore, it refers to in the marine environment, so over the ocean, basically. So an onshore, the rental. So once you secure a lease, okay, that's what happens in the lease sale, and that's known as the bonus. You can see the bonus is listed right here, okay? Once you secure the lease, you have to pay rentals, basically, and that, you know, for offshore is somewhere between $7 and $11 an acre. For onshore, it's $1.50 to $2 an acre, so a little bit cheaper. And then there are the royalty rates, right? And that's what I was just looking at. And the other one, 12.5% versus 18.75%. You know, in the case of onshore, so on land, much of it's regulated by the BLM, which is the Bureau of Land Management, Department of the Interior. However, we are regulated primarily by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, as I mentioned, offshore. This is for the United States. And just to kind of throw you out a real world example, the Tahiti Field, which is in the Gulf of Mexico, so it's an offshore production platform, they are producing 125,000, more or less, barrels per day of oil. You know, if that was $100 a barrel, and, you know, the price of a barrel of oil fluctuates wildly, it's a volatile commodity, really. It goes up and down quite a bit. But let's just go with $100 a barrel. That'd be a pretty reasonable price. You'd make money if you were an oil company selling it at $100 a barrel. But that would give you $12.5 million a day. Okay, so that's what they're getting in terms of oil. They're also producing gas. So oftentimes in these accumulations, you have a combination of natural gas and oil. So that's getting them a total of $350,000 a day. And so the total royalties on all of this, in other words, what's going to the government, is about $2.8 million per day. So you can imagine the government is like kind of excited generally about oil and gas exploration in the United States because they make money off of it. They actually get quite a bit. So that's important to note. You know, we have some historical information here in terms of billions of dollars on the y-axis and over time, you know, what our bids and our royalties have looked like. So you have bids, this sort of dotted, and then royalties have been going up. So in other words, you know, there could be a combination of production, but also an increase in the percentage, which has also occurred. In terms of millions of barrels, you know, most of what's being produced is happening on federal land, so that's BLM, as well as the offshore acreage. State leases, you know, there's also some land that is owned by the state, and they will also lease out for oil and gas production. It's been kind of on the decline, interestingly. Okay, so where does the revenue go? This is kind of what I was wanting to get at here, of all those royalties and bonuses and whatever. So this comes from 2013, so it's a little bit dated. But you can see, you know, we got a lot of different numbers here. So the total, let's start at the bottom. Okay, the total, this is such a massive number. So for 2013, this would be mineral royalty revenue for the United States, and this is for on the federal level. So we're talking $14.2 billion, more or less, $14.2 billion. And if we break that down, where does that go? Well, we have, you know, almost a billion going to Indian tribes. So, you know, a lot of this land where you have oil and gas exploration is happening on reservations, okay? So, you know, the tribes actually make quite a bit of money off this. And this is something that's going to come up. You know, it's a very split issue. I mean, this is not black and white stuff. There's a lot of nuance to these things. Historic Preservation Fund gets a little bit. Land and Water Conservation Fund. So, you know, these are funds just to sort of promote environmentalism and restoring the environment. Reclamation funds. So for sites where you have damage as a result of oil and gas exploration, you know, this is going to primarily be onshore. We got a fund to help with cleanup. So state share, offshore, onshore, you got bits there. And then the U.S. Treasury, right, just straight into the government coffers, gets over $8 billion. So over half of this total actually goes to the Treasury. Okay. So yeah, kind of interesting to see where that stuff goes. So where is it coming from? Well, oil and gas exists all throughout the world. Ultimately, you can see, you know, all continents, they've got a bit, right? One of the things that you would expect, though, is that it's going to be following areas that have the five play elements present, right? Because those elements are all necessary. Remember, source, migration, reservoir, seal, and trap. Okay, those are the five that we talked about. And so you need all of those present, right? And one of the key elements there is sedimentary rock, because sedimentary rocks like sandstones and limestones act as really good reservoirs. Where do you find those sedimentary rocks? Well, deltas, right, in continental margins. And so notice a lot of the oil and gas happens just off the shore, along the coastlines. Okay, and not in all cases, we miss a little bit here, but all around these coastlines, oil and gas exploration is happening. It's pretty much just like take a marker and draw it around each continent, and you're going to have oil and gas potential, because again, that's where your sedimentary rocks are being deposited in deltas, right as the rivers come into the ocean. So on the continental shelf, also deep water, there is some variation. You also get quite a bit in continental areas, but in this case, for example, going across North America, I mean, this was an inland sea at one point, right? So you need to have that marine incursion at some point in the geologic past, even if it doesn't exist today. Okay, looking at companies in the world, this is also very interesting to me. Who's making money off of oil and gas, and what countries have a lot of it? So in the upper one here, we can see that this is in 2020, so in billions of U.S. dollars. PetroChina, Sinopec, these are national oil companies of China, okay, are generating the most revenue in the world, more than Saudi Aramco. Then you get BP, ExxonMobil. So now we get some private companies, right? These three are national companies. They're owned by the state, okay? So in other words, this is owned by the Chinese government. Could be a partnership to some degree, but they are basically owned by the government. Saudi Aramco, also 100% integrated with the government. Then we get to BP, ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell, Total, which is a French company, Chevron, Gazprom, which is Russian, and Marathon. So, you know, then we start going down the list into private multinational companies like BP, ExxonMobil, et cetera. And notice their revenue is also fairly high, not as high as the nationals. Now let's look at reserves. Saudi Arabia at the top has 20% almost of worldwide reserves in oil and gas. That's incredible. Iran, 10%. Iraq, 8.5%. So the Middle East, again, just dominating in terms of reserves. Interesting, though, that Iran and Iraq and Kuwait, et cetera, these people with or countries with the most oil, at least in terms of reserves, are not at the top of the list in terms of revenue, right? And the point here is, and this is sort of a classic case with Petróleos Mexicanos, for example, and a lot of other national oil companies, Venezuela would be the real classic example these days. But it's a nationalized company, right? But it isn't very efficient ultimately at extracting the oil and gas from the subsurface. The technology involved, okay, requires a lot of knowledge ultimately, and a lot of capital, a lot of infrastructure. And so, you know, that's one thing that the private companies do fairly well. Saudi Aramco, on the other hand, I mean, they played it really interestingly in that they invited, Saudi Arabia invited multinationals into Saudi Arabia to explore for oil and gas a long time ago. But they always had requirements. In order for a multinational to come in and have a lease, they had to integrate like Saudi nationals into the company, into working on those prospects and working on those fields. And so in other words, they were creating knowledge, right? A knowledge base within the company or within the country, excuse me, in order to be able to continue oil and gas exploration production without the help of a multinational at some point. They were building that capacity, and they did it effectively. At this point, they are running the show in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Aramco is running the show, and they do it well, as you can see based on their revenue numbers here. And they have technology, et cetera. I mean, there are some cases where you get into some really sort of special situations where they may ask, you know, other multinationals to come in and help out, maybe contract a bit. But generally, they've got it under control. On the other hand, some of these other national companies, you know, maybe don't have good relationships with multinationals, so they don't really have that option as much. But they are sitting on a lot of oil and gas. Okay, whether they're one of the top revenue earners or not. It's just interesting. And that's what I was kind of getting to when I asked this question here. What companies have the largest oil gas reserves and which companies make the most money off hydrocarbons? It's not always the same, right? It's kind of interesting. Okay, so just a couple more things to discuss here. Number one, a fully integrated oil company. What is that? You know, you have a lot of different elements to oil and gas, you know, production. You start with what's called the upstream, which is actually extracting it from the subsurface. That's where a geologist like myself would be heavily involved. And then you move on to taking that material that you get out of the subsurface. You got to refine it. You got to turn it into products the consumers want, whether that's gasoline at the pump. And we're going to look at a whole bunch of other stuff that comes out of petroleum, tons of petroleum products out there. And then there's the downstream, right, which is you take these products out of the refinery and you actually sell them to consumers in a gas station, for example. Okay, so, you know, we're looking at the world and, you know, where we have large accumulations, largest conventional fields in the world. In other words, you know, where you don't have to do like special technological tricks to get it out. The largest in terms of gas, natural gas, is going to be this one called South Pars in Iran and Qatar. Hawar, which is in Saudi Arabia, is the largest oil field in the world. We'll look at that a little bit more closely. And then you have Kuwait, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Russia, Kazakhstan, Venezuela. I mean, this is where the majority of your oil and gas exists in the subsurface, some of which is being produced well, some of which is not. In the United States, we have Prudhoe Bay. This is up in Alaska. Okay, that's one of our largest. And then an area of Kansas. So we got onshore production as well. We got in Southern California, kind of all over the place. Okay, so what can you do with a barrel of oil? I was kind of going into this, all sorts of stuff. You can make asphalt. Okay, you can drive trucks and cars, jets, wax for birthday candles, lubricants, clearly. You know, here's your car, liquefied gas such as propane. So you get a lot of different types of fuels coming out of it. You can generate electricity, right? And that does happen, actually. And then a whole bunch of products like, you know, toothbrushes, plastic cups, combs, shirts, if it's acrylic or some sort of polyester. Telephones, dustpans, plastic. Okay, so all this stuff, right, is coming out of petroleum. It's got a ton of different uses. I do want to look a little bit more closely at a specific oil field. This is Saudi Arabia. Okay, and you can see in green are oil fields, and then in red are gas fields. Okay, the one that we were just looking at, which was called South Pars, the largest natural gas and just fossil fuel field in the world, was this guy. Okay, you can see it goes between Qatar and Iran, this sort of red area. So it's within the Persian Gulf, basically. We're going to be looking at some images of Kuwait here in just a moment. So just note where that's at here between Iraq and the Persian Gulf. Okay, so we got Gawar or Hawar. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. I've had some folks explain it to me, and I have a hard time making the sounds properly. But yeah, the largest oil field in the world is right here in Saudi Arabia. Okay, you got pipelines that are moving that material over to the coast in the Red Sea, put them on tankers, send it all over the world. Okay, this would be what some of that, some of those facilities would look like in the desert. Pretty incredible infrastructure out there, whether we're talking about wells, refineries, et cetera. This is actually a well field, okay, that's shown here. It's sort of processing facility. Okay, if we look at a cross-section through the largest oil field in the world, conventional oil in Saudi Arabia, it's a cross-section. So we're looking at it like, you know, to the side, right? You got layers of rock. Look at that. Just like we saw at the very first slide here, layers of sedimentary rock. This sort of teal-colored one here is going to be this Jurassic limestone. See, it says the reservoir rock is this Jurassic limestone. High porosity, up to 35% porosity. So 35% of that limestone is pore space that you can put fluid in, oil. 280 feet thick, 6,000 to 7,000 feet below the surface, etc. Okay, Hawar structure is this little guy right here, right? This is your trap, right? Upside down bowl. So it's holding on to it. And then in the Cretaceous, so this is just younger rock up here as you go from older rock at the bottom to younger at top. So sitting up on top here in the Cretaceous and possibly even the Tertiary is a seal rock, which is in this case salt. Okay, it's a type of salt called anhydrite. Interesting. What else we got? Well, talked about the trap, the reservoir, the source, right? So another play element is the source. Where is the oil coming from? Well, it's a marine shelf mudstone with quite a bit of organic material, and it's shown here as this black that exists kind of within the reservoir rock, interestingly. Okay, I'm going to click on that and see if it takes us somewhere in the world. Yeah, let's go take a look at Saudi Arabia. So where am I at? Well, let's zoom out. You're going to kind of recognize where we're just at in that image a second ago. So there's Qatar, Saudi Arabia here. It is the desert, people. It is the desert. See this road, the 75 that comes down here? This thing is going through the oil field. And if I zoom in, I can see all these little things here. These are wells. Okay, little well pads. Well, this has additional stuff going on, right? But yeah, see this infrastructure down here? You got all these different power lines coming around. Wow, this is a lot of power lines in this spot. But yeah, this is the oil field. The sleepy giant. I don't know what that is. But yeah, you can kind of cruise around and look. I mean, this is all in the middle of the desert. Tons of infrastructure, right? Supporting oil production along that entire trend, which pretty much goes this whole length through here. It goes this whole length. Oh, and just as a side note, look, you got agriculture out there. That's incredible. Wells. So that's kind of, you know, just an example of how production is happening in this case in the Gulf of Mexico. It's pretty interesting. I'll go ahead and bring my video back in. Why not? While I'm switching things back around here. Okay, so continuing on, you know, we've been talking a lot about the geology, some of the economics. Well, there's also a downside to oil and gas exploration, and this was shown very clearly in the Persian Gulf War. So, I mean, there's a lot of examples of environmental catastrophe from the oil and gas sector. This is one of the more incredible and really just egregious examples of that. So, during the Gulf War, ultimately, this was a war that the United States was heavily involved in. Right? It was Iraq ultimately invaded Kuwait. The United States came in and help drive Iraq back out of Kuwait, basically. But Kuwait is a, you know, an oil-rich country, right? And here you can see Persian Gulf oil and gas fields all over the place. There was the one we just looked at, Gawar, here. But Kuwait is going to exist up in this area. You can see Kuwait's labeled right in here. And there's a lot of oil and gas right on the edge here. So it ends up being a small country, but a very rich country. And during that war, basically, well, I've got some notes here. I'll just, you know, read this off. It's pretty intense. It was revealed that in a last-ditch attempt to prevent U.S. forces from landing on the beaches of Kuwait, Iraqi forces intentionally dumped oil into the Persian Gulf. They released oil from 8 oil tankers, a refinery, 2 terminals, and a tank field. Since the Iraqis anticipated an amphibious invasion, they also dug long trenches down the coastline and filled them with oil. Just so much oil, what you gonna do? This act of, quote, environmental terrorism released a total of 11 million barrels of crude oil into the Persian Gulf, resulting in the largest oil spill in history. 11 million barrels of crude oil into the Persian Gulf. I got one other thing to say about that as soon as I finish. For the next 3 months, oil continued to spill into the Gulf at a rate of up to 6,000 barrels a day. Furthermore, while the Iraqis were retreating, they set ablaze a reported 732 oil wells. So when the Kuwait Oil Company first announced this in May of 1991, they calculated the oil wells were burning as many as 6 million barrels a day. That's amazing. And that image in the background is one of these oil wells just burning, just going. Out of control, right? And one of the things that's kind of interesting here is that, you know, it spilled into the Persian Gulf, into this water body. And this is kind of what it looks like when you get an oil spill in water. Oil sits on the top, right? And so you get this, I don't know, you could call it beautiful, but it's also an environmental catastrophe. It's a, you know, this oil sheen on top, you know, because oil is floating, ultimately it's buoyant. And this is, you know, an image of some ships out there that are supposedly trying to do a little bit of cleanup. But one of the things that's interesting about the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Mexico is that both have natural seeps. Okay, we don't have, you know, these numbers, you know, 6,000 barrels a day naturally going into these water bodies. That's insane. But there is a natural amount that's seeping from the subsurface into the water at the water bottom. And as a result of that, oil that just kind of exists naturally in the system, a small amount, right? There's an ecosystem that's been created around that so that when we have a big oil spill, a catastrophe like this, incredibly, like the same thing happened with Macondo in the Gulf of Mexico, the oil, that material, the bacteria and such that naturally exist in that environment, that are endemic to that environment because there are natural seeps, that bacteria, it blooms, right? Because all of a sudden there's all this food around. Oh my gosh. So it just blooms and it gets huge. And it actually really does a great job of helping to mitigate the problem. I mean, there's still a lot of environmental problems that go along with this. But that is to say that in a place like the Persian Gulf or the Gulf of Mexico, if you're going to have an oil spill, that's where you want it, because that's where you have naturally existing oil-eating bacteria in the environment to kind of help you out a little bit, as opposed to this location. Okay, this is Valdez in Alaska, and this is ultimately a tanker terminal. So you have the pipeline that brings oil down and from the North Slope of Alaska, puts it on tankers, and then it ships it around the world. Well, the Valdez oil spill, which happened in this area, you know, spilled a lot of oil into the water. And ultimately, this is not an area where you have natural seeps of oil, right? It's being brought from the North Slope all the way down here and then shipped. So this isn't an oil province here. You do not have endemic bacteria in this area eating oil, small amounts of it as it seeps into the water. And so this oil spill actually persisted in ways that the other two did not, the other two being the Persian Gulf and the Macondo oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And some of that, at least, is because it just doesn't have that naturally occurring oil-eating bacteria that can bloom, that can go crazy and help ultimately mitigate the problem. So that's interesting. Okay, so just another slide or two on refining. I know I've been going long here. Refining, again, is where we're breaking it out into all those the crude oil into all those different products that we were talking about just a little bit ago. And this is something I put together just to give a summary, really, of what goes into refining a barrel of oil. So ultimately, you heat the oil up, okay? You heat that crude oil up to a temperature, and it shows the numbers here, you know, over 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, 600 degrees C. That mixture starts to boil, so it's vaporizing. It forms a gas, and then and most of it's in vapor phase at that point, and so it starts to rise through this column, okay? And that column, you know, as you get higher and higher, the temperature is ultimately going down. And so there's different material. When a substance in the vapor reaches a height where the temperature of the column is equal to that substance boiling point. So when we talk about substance, what are we talking about? All these things that are listed: asphalt, industrial fuel, diesel fuel, jet fuel, motor gasoline, gasoline, LPG, that's liquefied petroleum gas, diesel fuel, jet fuel, gasoline, or liquefied petroleum gas here. That's LPG gasoline, sorry. Right. And then that ends up being kind of at the top here along with vapors, et cetera. So these are all your different substances which have different boiling points. And so when we hit different levels in here, one of these will condense out and you collect it, you sort of siphon it off, and now you have your diesel fuel. Now you have your jet fuel. Now you have your gasoline, et cetera. Yeah, ultimately they're passing through condensers, right? And then they end up being stored. They could be processed even more beyond that. See, I'm going to go ahead and get rid of my image there so that you can see what's in the sort of bottom right corner here for just a moment. But yeah, this is the last slide. I have an oil. I am going to talk about natural gas. Much shorter lecture, but that is coming also in this week. So stay tuned for that. Thanks for listening.